Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I love so many true crime channels here on YouTube. There are so many creators that do a fantastic job telling their stories that I love to watch and listen to. One of the things I feel I have to offer that maybe is a little different is that I'm old. And I've actually lived through many of the stories that we all like to talk about. And today I'm bringing you a perfect example of that. If you lived outside of Manhattan back at the time this happened, you didn't even know what a club kid was. But this story changed all of that. As we sat and watched the gruesome events unfold on the nightly news and then on the talk show circuit. This story stands out in my mind very clearly as not only different, but especially evil because it's a tale about friends who kill friends. I want to thank my viewer and TikTok friend, MamaMacabre43, for reminding me about this case. I got so excited when I thought about writing it because this was one of the first true crime cases I really got into. This is the story of Michael Alig, the club kid killer. Let's get into it. April 17th, 1990. It's a spring day in St. George, Utah. I'm 20 years old, a new mom with an 18-month-old at home. I've just come home from my morning shift working as a receptionist in a state mental health facility, and I turn on the TV to fix myself and my daughter some lunch and to watch Geraldo, which is what I usually did at that time of day. And this is what I see. The day's talk show topic was about something I had never heard of. There were some very unusual people on the show that day, and they were using the term celebutants. Later, that term would be changed to club kids. Now, come with me back to the dark ages before the internet. And remember, I am in a small, rural, southern Utah town. I haven't traveled. I know nothing of the world. The online world doesn't exist. And all I am exposed to is what is in my hometown, maybe California, Las Vegas, and what I see on TV. Well, believe me, I had never seen anything like this before. Who were these fabulously strange people on this stage? And how did they dare go out in public dressed like this? What was the point of it all? I was instantly captivated by the entire thing. The audience is loudly and quite rudely laughing at these people, at the names they use, and at how they look. They're quite obviously freaks, right? And back then, it wasn't rude to laugh at freaks. I didn't really think of them as freaks. I remember feeling like they were the bravest people I'd ever seen. I would never dare go out dressed like that, and I thought they were pretty amazing. On that stage, we had no idea at the time, were people who went on to become very famous. Famous journalists, famous club promoters, and this person here, who decades later would revolutionize the world of drag and win 12 Emmys. Maybe you've heard of her. This, my friends, is a very young RuPaul. I just love this so much. I remember this like it was yesterday. Sitting on that stage was one of the more unusual looking people. And I remember thinking, why would he want to make himself look ugly when he's so handsome? I didn't understand the point of this culture or these costumes. And I didn't know at the time he was one of the hottest people in New York City then. This is Michael Alig. Michael Alig was born on April 29, 1966 in South Bend, Indiana. His parents divorced when he was 4 years old. Michael graduated from Penn High School with straight A's in the top 3% of his class. Michael had come out as gay very early on. Even for present day, to be out as homosexual in your teens is a lot. Now think of it in the 80s, the early 80s even. Michael's openness about his sexuality was a precursor for other things to come in his life. He was always leading the pack. He was a trailblazer, not just for queer people, but for people from different subcultures all around the country. Michael was bullied because, of course, he was, and he wanted to get out of Indiana as fast as possible. He graduated from high school in 1984 and headed to New York City to attend Fordham University to study architecture. But then he transferred to the Fashion Institute of Technology. One of his classmates there was the boyfriend of artist Keith Haring. This man and Keith introduced Michael Alig to the world of New York City nightlife. And before long, Michael had dropped out of school and was working as a busboy at Danceteria, which was a very famous club. Michael was smart and he was calculating. He very quickly learned the ins and outs of the club business. And before long, he was working as a party promoter. People liked him. He was approachable enough, but also edgy enough. He was nice, but not nice enough not to be cool. And he had a really good head on his shoulders. Not long after becoming a party promoter, Michael began showing up to his parties with his friends, and all of them were dressed very unusually. Soon, people around them were doing the same thing, each person coming up with an alter ego, a separate persona, and those characters had flamboyant costumes to match their personalities. Like I said earlier, they were first called celebutantes, but later became known simply as club kids. Drugs were a big part of the scene, and so was great music, and it quickly took off. Club kids were soon everywhere, and like I said, some of them got very famous. Amanda Lepore, RuPaul, like I said, and the one other one that I really remember is Richie Rich. If you go back in your memory, you might remember Richie Rich because he later created a fashion brand called Heatherette. And for a hot minute, Heatherette was all the rage, with celebrities like Paris Hilton and Naomi Campbell walking in their fashion shows. In 1988, Michael Alig was hired by Peter Gation, who owned the Limelight, which had not really been a very cool club, but Peter was determined to change that. He was wanting to make it the club in New York. So Peter hires Michael, who in his earlier days was very against the use of drugs. There are multiple stories of Michael taking people's drugs away from them and flushing them down the toilet. Most people who were there at the time say that Michael didn't even drink. He wanted to come off as though he was part of the drug and bar scene, and so he often pretended to be drunk or on drugs, when in fact, he was stone cold sober. Over time, however, that all changed, and soon, Michael was not only using, he was using on a daily basis. This was a very wild time in the party, club, and art worlds of New York. Many times those three worlds combined. It was common to go to a club and see something like this, an art installation. This one's by Mark Garabino. It's a pool filled with tomato juice made to look like alphabet soup. Can you imagine being the guy that had to stand in that all night? Ugh. Andy Warhol had been a large part of this scene until his unexpected death in 1987, and his passing left a hole in the scene. Who would be the new king of the glitterati in New York? Well, Michael Alig thought it should be him. His time at Danceteria was life-changing for him and for others. Madonna was once a waitress at Danceteria. Sade was a bartender. LL Cool J was an elevator attendant. It was a very hot place, and it was the place to see and be seen, to mingle with the underground and the famous alike, the stars of the city. Michael began throwing what he called outlaw parties at places like Dunkin' Donuts and Burger King. These parties were kind of an early and more destructive version of what we know as a flash mob. When Michael was on drugs, he was notoriously poorly behaved. He was known to urinate in people's drinks. He threw people off of stages. He threw $100 bills on the floor to watch people try and grab for them. It wasn't too long before the fame had quickly gone to his head, and he was out of control. He was using drugs every day, and he was spiraling quickly. Michael was arrested several times and sent to rehab after each arrest, but he continued to use, and soon he was fired and he lost his job at the Limelight. Michael later claimed that he had been examined by a psychiatrist at rehab once, and this doctor told him he had the worst case of histrionic personality disorder he'd ever seen. That's believable. Now, these parties. I read things that happened at these parties that I won't go into, but some of it was far beyond wild. Some of it was just gross. The people were, of course, trying to push boundaries. I get that. There's no doubt that they pushed them. But also, they were just so high at times, there was no inhibition. And sometimes there was no shame. Shame is not a healthy thing, but dignity is. Remember when people used to have dignity? I think a lot of people, especially what I see on social media, people my age, have forgotten what it's like to be dignified. Michael Alig continued on as a party promoter after he was fired, and the club kid scene grew. A few after his first appearance on Geraldo, Michael appeared again in 1994, but this time he brought with him an entirely new cast of characters, much more outrageous and over the top than before. Geraldo introduces the club kids and they come out in a line, kind of a little parade, showing off their homemade costumes, their wild makeup and hair, and posing for the camera. The costumes look a bit crafty now, but back then this was pretty edgy stuff. In a parade of wild costumes, there was one that definitely stood out. It's hard to miss a man in a red leather outfit with 8-foot-wide red feathered wings on his back. I distinctly remember seeing this man in this costume. Now you can get online and order a pair of giant wings delivered to your door. They even have a string that moves them up and down, or they're battery motor operated. Back then, I had never seen anything like this, except maybe in a painting. The man makes his way onto the stage, showing off his flashy costume complete with gigantic angel's wings. This is Angel Melendez, and there was no way to know, sitting in the audience of this talk show or watching from home, just how intertwined Angel Melendez and Michael Alig would become, or just how tragically their story would end. 8-year-old Andre Angel Melendez moves with his family from Colombia to New York City. By the time Angel was a teenager, he was dealing drugs at the gay bars that he frequented. Soon he was working at the Limelight, and through that job, he met Michael Alig. After Michael was fired from the Limelight, Angel had the monopoly of the drug sales in the club. But then it was shut down by federal agents after a sting proved that it was in fact kind of an open market for illegal drug trade. At some point, Angel and Michael had a disagreement about money owed for drugs. Michael claimed that Angel owed him a large sum of money, and Angel vehemently denied that to be the case. While the two remained somewhat friendly, there was always this underlying tension between them because of this ongoing dispute over the supposed debt. Deep in addiction and never fully coherent, Michael Alig began to lose control. He was like a loud, angry, destructive storm, and soon Angel Melendez would find himself right in its path. March 17th, 1996. Michael Alig, his friend Robert Riggs, who was known as Freeze, and Angel Melendez had been out partying. Michael was high, as he usually was, and as the trio rode up the elevator to get to Michael's apartment, he snapped. He became enraged at Angel about the money he felt he was owed, and suddenly he shoved Angel up against the walls of the elevator, put his hands around Angel's neck, and began to strangle him. A scuffle ensued, and both Michael and Angel threw punches. Michael and Freeze then pulled Angel into Michael's apartment, where they worked to restrain him. Michael used a pillow to try and suffocate Angel, and while his face was covered, both Michael and Freeze beat him over the head with a hammer. Now, to this point, I can somewhat picture this. You've got three guys on drugs. There's tension between them. They're all out of it, and they get into a fight. Of course, it's awful. Of course, it's not right. But I can picture this. I cannot picture or understand what happens next. Michael and Freeze get a bottle of Drano and inject it into Angel's veins. This barbaric act kills Angel. Even if he could have survived the head wounds, he would not have survived the Drano. It's a very cold and sadistic element to this crime that has always bothered me. There's something so calculated and maniacal about that detail. Clinical, almost, you know, very cold. I guess maybe when you're used to being around syringes, it makes it less so. But for me, I don't know. It's just something I find particularly gruesome. Michael and Freeze then put Angel's body in the bathtub of Michael's apartment, and they pretty much passed out. Michael later claimed that when he woke up and was somewhat sober, he was horrified to see the body of his friend in his bathtub and could not believe what he had done. He told interviewers that he doesn't remember most of that night and that his memory of the events has never improved. So one day goes by, and then two. Michael and Freeze continue to pack the bathtub with ice and went about their daily activities as though nothing had happened. But they knew something was going to have to be done. A couple of days after the murder, Michael Alig called his mother crying, and she knew he was high. He was hysterical, telling her that he shouldn't be alive, that he was going to end his life. But a few minutes into the conversation, he hung up on his mother, and that was kind of that. She didn't try to call him back, and she didn't hear from him again for a bit. The next day, the body began to smell. By the fourth day, it was really starting to be noticeable, and Michael and Freeze knew they had to do something. Robert Freeze Riggs went to Macy's to buy large knives and a sturdy box, but he couldn't find a large box to purchase. Freeze gets back to the apartment, and he's like, now what? Michael Alec told Freeze that for 10 bags of heroin, he would cut up the body. Michael got very, very high and started the gruesome task. The parts were put into garbage bags and duffel bags. The torso was put into a large box that Freeze found in the basement of the apartment building. The duffel bags and the box were then thrown into the Hudson River. By the end of the week, people had noticed Angel's absence. Friends tried calling him and going to his apartment. They were concerned when they couldn't get in touch with him. Soon, word spread through the club kid community that Angel was missing. And unbelievably, Michael Alec began to tell everyone who would listen that he killed Angel. Michael made jokes about the murder, so much so that those who heard them thought it was simply another ploy of Michael's to get the attention he so desperately craved all of the time, and no one really paid attention to his confession. There were a few people, however, that weren't so sure Michael Alec was joking. On April 26, 1996, about a month after the murder, Michael Musto, who was part of the scene and who also wrote for the Village Voice, decided to do an article on Angel's disappearance. He didn't use any names in the article, but he included details of the alleged murder that seemed a little too specific. Somebody on the scene was talking. The day after Musto's article ran, the New York Post wrote a column about the alleged murder as well. For months, nothing happened. This was a gay man, a known drug dealer and drug user. And as we know, those people aren't really at the top of the priorities list sometimes. Plus, the police had no body, no crime scene. They didn't even have any proof that there had been a murder. So we can't really put too much blame on them for not doing a lot of investigating. Angel's family and friends continued to look for him, hoping that they would find him. And then, when they did, it wasn't in the way they had prayed for. April 1996. A group of children are playing on the beach at Miller Field on Staten Island. There had been a tropical storm a few days earlier, and a lot of debris had been pushed onto the beach. These children approached a large box that had been floating on the surface, and because the box was lined with cork, it was floating. As soon as the kids got near, they ran screaming for their parents. The police were called, and inside the box was found the dismembered torso of Angel Melendez. The body was taken into custody and labeled as a John Doe. It was tagged and labeled and placed in refrigeration. Now, it sat there for months as people continued to look for Angel. In September, months later, a second body that is totally unrelated to this case was fished out of the Hudson River. And for whatever reason, this body being found lit a fire under one of the detectives assigned to the John Doe from months earlier. The Staten Island police had read the articles and heard the rumors about Michael Alec and Robert Freeze Riggs, and they'd heard the chatter that they had killed missing Angel Melendez months earlier. This police officer went and got a warrant for Angel's dental records, and he delivered them to the coroner. The coroner found that the records matched. They had found Angel Melendez. He was the John Doe that had been sitting in refrigeration for months. Because the body had been taken into custody months earlier and labeled as a John Doe, the people on the club scene were not aware that the body had been found. So imagine their shock and surprise when they heard that not only had a body been found, but it was confirmed to be that of their missing friend and family member, Angel. Everywhere he went, people were telling Michael Alec about the discovery. And although Michael tried to play off the stress he was feeling, it soon began to take its toll. When word came to Michael that the police were getting a warrant, he panicked. And on December 5th, 1996, Michael packed up and fled with his then-boyfriend, Brian. They drove to Toms River, New Jersey, and checked into a motel room to hide. Well, they didn't run far enough or fast enough, and soon the police were right behind them. Just hours after he ran, police found Michael Alec and took him into custody. Robert Freeze Riggs was located in Manhattan, and he too was placed under arrest. At first, Michael insisted that the murder happened as an act of self-defense. It's important to note that the police were walking kind of delicately with Michael because they needed him. For months, they had been building a major drug case against Michael's former boss at the Limelight, Peter Gation. The cops felt that they needed Michael Alec to testify against Peter if they were to obtain a guilty verdict against the club owner. So they were going a little easy on Michael Alec in the beginning. Robert Freeze Riggs was feeling a little differently. He was tired of this, and he wanted it off his chest. He made a confession to the police. He wrote, "On a Sunday in March of 1996, I was at home, and Michael Alec and Angel Melendez were loudly arguing and getting louder. I opened the room and started towards the other bedroom, at which point Michael Alec was yelling, 'Help me, get him off me.' He started shaking Angel violently and banging him against the wall. He was yelling, 'You better get me my money or I'll break your neck.' I grabbed the hammer and hit Angel over the head. I hit him maybe a total of 3 times, and then Michael hit him with the hammer." While Freeze confessed, Michael Alec continued to insist that the murder was an act of self-defense. It became clear to the police that they weren't going to be able to definitively prove which of the two, Michael or Freeze, was telling the truth. They also recognized that there was a strong argument for self-defense because of the fight that had occurred. They had 2 people telling roughly the same story, and that is sometimes tough in front of a jury. Soon the police realized they needed to strike a deal. The prosecution offered them both the same deal: plead guilty to manslaughter and get 10 to 20 years. Both of the men took the deal. Michael Alec went off to prison and also spent time in the psychiatric ward at Rikers Island. In 2000, he was caught using heroin and was placed in solitary confinement, where he stayed for a total of 2.5 years, getting sent back several times for dirty drug tests. Robert Freeze Riggs had a better prison record. He seemed to clean up in prison for the most part and did his time without anything noteworthy occurring. Michael became eligible for parole in 2006. It has been reported that the parole board denied his request because of the movie. Let's talk about the movie. In 2003, a film, now a somewhat notorious film, was released that detailed the events of this crime and also fictionalized it. The film is called Party Monster, and it stars Macaulay Culkin as Michael Alec. If you haven't seen this film, I recommend it. It's a little low budget, the acting is a little over the top at times, but it's worth the view. So supposedly, the story goes, members of the parole board watched Party Monster before Michael's parole hearing, and seeing this fictionalized, bigger-than-life depiction of his life and the crime, they denied him parole. So, I don't know. First, we would have to validate that that story is true. We would have to know that they actually did watch the film. But if it is true, that's disturbing. A parole board should not be basing its decision on works of mainly fiction. Yes, it was about Michael Alec. Yes, it talked about the crime, but it also played up a lot of things. Again, who knows if it's true? I hope that didn't happen. I really do. I don't want to believe our justice system works that way, even though I know it does. After Michael was denied parole, he again tested positive for drug use. Michael Alec had a very longtime friend and kind of his mentor named James St. James. They had known each other since Michael's early days on the club scene. James and Michael stayed in contact after Michael went to prison. James ended up writing a book about this event called Disco Bloodbath. While Michael was in prison, after the advent of the internet and blogs became popular, James St. James started writing a blog called Phone Calls from a Felon. In this blog, he would post, word for word, his conversations with Michael from behind bars. People remained fascinated and interested in this very unique and controversial person. Robert Freeze Riggs was paroled in 2010 after about 13 years in prison, which was early parole. Michael was finally paroled in 2014 after doing 17 years in prison. He went right back to his old neighborhood in New York City, but his life was different. He was required to mind an 8 p.m. curfew and to undergo anger management and counseling along with drug treatment. As you would expect, he immediately started giving interviews. After 17 years locked away, Michael Alec was thirstier than ever for the spotlight. A few months after his release, he started a YouTube channel with fellow club kid Ernie Glam that was called The PU. Here you can see them filming shots for the YouTube channel. In May of 2015, Michael's paintings were featured at an art fair in New York. And in June of that same year, he held his one and only art show in three separate galleries. As you can see, Michael liked to paint his friends, and he liked to paint himself. His friends are very interesting, though. Who wouldn't want to paint them? Michael then got involved with DJ Kiyoki's Monday night party called Outrage. This was a very successful event and brought large crowds of older club kids and young club kids alike. Michael also starred in some very low-budget films, and as you can imagine, being back on the scene brought back all of his old habits, and soon Michael was using again. He was arrested in February of 2017 for smoking meth in a park, and people began to notice that he wasn't doing as well as they had hoped. When the pandemic hit, Michael, along with a group of friends, began hosting virtual Zoom parties every Saturday night, and people say those parties really helped them get through the toughest days of the lockdown. Then, on Christmas Eve 2020, just before midnight, Michael's boyfriend found him unconscious on the floor of their Manhattan home. He called 911, but there was nothing paramedics could do. Michael Alig, king of the club kids, was dead of a drug overdose at 54 years old. I wish I could give you a little more information on Angel Melendez, maybe more about his life or his family, but sadly, there just isn't a lot of information online that's very trustworthy. As we often see in these cases, the focus gets shifted to the most unusual and colorful person involved in the story. And here, that's Michael Alig. I always like to find video of the killer speaking because I feel it gives us an insight into them. It lets us look into their eyes as they speak. So here is a little raw footage of Michael Alig in prison.
I guess that's the third time I OD'd at Peter, yeah. Oh, wait a minute. My heart stopped three times, but I guess the only time that it stopped for like a really long time was at a party Peter was throwing at the Mayfair Hotel. And I guess this was in March of 96. In January and February of 96, each month, I had respiratory failure once a month. And it was usually from a combination of cocaine and Special K and Rohypnol and heroin. And the first two times, the cocaine did it. I'd done some cocaine and then I stopped breathing. But then the third time was I was doing all those other drugs and we'd been up for days and I did three lines of heroin. And all I remember is telling everybody in the room how good I felt, that I've never felt that I've finally reached that point to where that you're always trying to get at. You know, that high that you're always, the perfect high, you're not too down, you're not too up, you're just perfect. And I told everybody, I wish everybody felt the way I did right then, and then I fell down. I fell down into my plate of food, and I guess my heart stopped, and Gitsy, I think, tried to give me mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. They called 911, and Peter ran around hiding all the drugs, and they came and put an oxygen mask or something on me and started my heart. And I woke on the stretcher going into the ambulance and I had a mask on me. And I just thought somebody was trying to suffocate me because I couldn't breathe. And I saw someone with a hand over my face. So I tried to push off and they wouldn't let me. And then eventually I started breathing. And they thought I was trying to kill myself. So they took me to the hospital and wouldn't let me go home because they thought I was going to kill myself. And I told them, you know, why would you think I'm trying to kill myself? And they said, well, anybody who's putting that amount of drugs in their body must be on purpose trying to kill themselves. And I told them, no, I wasn't. But when I woke up, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know my name, and I didn't know any of my friends' names. And I didn't know where I'd been. I didn't know where I'd worked. And I didn't know where I lived. And I didn't know anything for like 3 hours.
This is a sad story. Think about Angel Melendez riding in that elevator, believing he is going to a friend's house to hang out, and instead he ends up dead. I'm sad I couldn't find more information on him, but I hope we remember his face and his name, and I hope we remember what happened to him. I found these photos of Robert Freeze Riggs as he appears now, and he seems to be doing well. I think they're both quite fortunate to be paroled. We see people get life sentences for murders like this, so yes, both men should be thankful that they ever got to see the light of day, even if for one, it didn't take him long for his demons to find him right where they left him on that terrible night. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video, and if you really want to support me, join my Patreon. I'm starting to turn out some bonus content, and I really like interacting with you guys there. Stay safe and be kind to each other, and I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant, Sweet Tango Apples, guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples, too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.